Welcome to Meat and Potatoes Podcast. Today we're joined by Jared Hutchings, who is the Managing Director of Peer Venture Partners. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to be in the studio.
Yeah, you bet.
Peer Venture Partners. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, we're an early stage venture firm focused entirely on crypto. So we look for outstanding teams doing, you know, really pre-seed, seed, and Series A. We'll invest in both, you know, equity and tokens.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unravel there.
Yeah.
Even in 2021, even, you know, I talk about it a decent amount, but I can't claim to know too much.
Yeah.
Let's start with tokens. How does one invest in tokens? Well, let's explain what they are first and then how to invest in them.
So let's talk about blockchain and then crypto and then maybe that'll break it down. So blockchain is really just a ledger. And it has three key features. It has a timestamp, it's immutable, and it's auditable. Everybody can see it. And then a crypto or a token is really an application that sits on top of that ledger that takes advantage of those qualities. So that's its very simplest. The most well-known of these is cryptocurrency, but there's other types of applications that you can run on top of the blockchain.
Okay. And so a token is invested in what way?
A token is invested in. Well, you can acquire a token. I mean, when Bitcoin first launched, for instance, is the most well-known crypto. They were acquired just by doing a transaction on this blockchain to show that you have one of these 21 million tokens on the ledger. And now there's lots of ways to acquire or invest in a token. Some involve participating as a market participant somewhere on these new platforms. Sometimes it's just buying a token. So there's lots of ways, which is why it's kind of exciting and cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been doing venture and investing for quite some time. How is this different with what you're currently focused on versus what you've done 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah. So crypto's different, and I think there's a potential for people who are very excited about crypto to say it in a very enthusiastic way that can be off-putting, that it's going to solve all of our cultural ailments and be this kind of saving balm. So I hope I don't do that, but I am very enthusiastic about it. I think there's an analogy with playgrounds, if we can go there, that might be a great way to explain why I'm excited about crypto. When the internet first happened, it was a little like a playground to me, where it was new, exciting. There was a feeling really that anything was possible, and there were all these tools that really anybody could use to create something new and interesting. And we weren't really sure what it was going to be. If you go back to Marc Andreessen's interview with Katie Couric, he gave a terrible answer about what the internet was going to be used for. I think he talked about sharing photos or buying toys, and he didn't really capture in any really articulate way, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. We could just feel that something new and exciting was going to happen. And so we started experimenting and building, different things on the playground. And then what happened was we started to see some exciting things. We could send messages from one side of the playground to the other, or we could, share videos and music, and we started to create an experiment. And then the big kids showed up, and they said, well, this is really exciting what you guys are doing. I'll tell you what, we're going to make a better version of everything you're working on, and we're going to let you use it for free. And everybody got excited about this. And so we got all these cool products and services basically for free that emerged out of the internet. And then what happened was, people started to realize that the big kids had, and really not because they necessarily had malicious intent, they were doing the best for their constituencies, but they started to control the whole experience on the playground. What information people saw, they analyzed who everybody talked to on the playground for their benefit, and they started to create an experience, and a phenomenon happened where these networks emerged that hadn't really existed before, wherein they weren't necessarily making the content or making the product or service, they were curating the participants around the network, how the content creators share that content with the content consumers. And so we see all these big big platforms and big playground equipment come out of this very exciting and interesting that hadn't existed before. But what a couple kids noticed was that the big kids were controlling the experience and everything that everyone saw and who won King of the Mountain at recess and all these things. And so some of the kids decided we're going to go experiment on a new playground. And so they left. And they went and experimented on the new playground. And what can we create that's kind of that's new and interesting and different and that's kind of free from these qualities of the first playground? And when they built the first swing set, something kind of magical happened. They realized that it was indestructible, and they had never seen. They really anticipated this was going to happen. That it was kind of amazing. Like this is indestructible. It had these unique qualities, and everything on the new playground right now, and as people are starting to experiment, is not fancy. It doesn't have the polish and the features and the bells and whistles of the first playground equipment, but it's pretty cool in that it has these qualities. And some of the other kids were like, wow, this is really interesting. You can see how it works. So it has these qualities like we talked about with the blockchain. It has this auditable, it's immutable, unbreakable, and it has these it has a timestamp. And so it has this kind of really interesting way to work with it. And so, some of the kids are like, look, let's go back to the playground and tell everybody they've been productized by the playground equipment on the first one. And so they go back and they say, hey, you've all been productized by the playground equipment. It's all controlled by the big kids come to the new playground. Everybody kind of looks up for a second and they look back down and they're good. And so, but they get a few early people to come and people keep working on it. And they realize that on the new playground, they have to give up this idea of that everything's free. And instead of everything being free, it's more of a meritocracy where you actually have to bring something to bear to help make these platforms possible. But by virtue of doing that, the new playground equipment is owned by everybody. And there's rewards everywhere, all over the playground. And one of the clever kids in the new playground sees that there's rewards everywhere and gets this idea and goes back to the first playground, climbs the highest structure on the first playground, says, hey, everybody, there's a new playground where everybody can get rich. And then this time, a lot more people come to the new playground. And so I think that's a perfect analogy for me what's happening with crypto. I think that evolution of technology is inevitable, and that's definitely happening whether we want it to or not. And we're building equipment on the new playground. I don't fall in the camp of crypto utopians that believe that, no matter what, everything on the new playground is going to be perfect and it's going to solve all these problems. But it does have these new qualities that are really interesting. And Bitcoin is interesting in that there's no CEO of Bitcoin. There's nobody really content, but everybody, people talk about it existing in a decentralized way. That doesn't mean it's in a vacuum somewhere. It just means that it's more culturally embedded culturally. It's been adopted in a deeper way culturally. And so I think that's what's exciting to me is to see that on this new playground, we can build platforms and networks and services that everybody can participate with. All the market participants can help guide the evolution of these kind of key features. And one other thing that's interesting about the whole thing to us, and specifically with what we're doing, because we're investing in playground equipment, so the new platforms, new networks that we hope to be very enduring, permanent parts of culture, but as permanent as they can be. But also the companies around those. And if you look at version one of the playground, you have kind of key features, playground equipment, whether it's a Facebook or a YouTube, what have you, that create entire ecosystems. They create companies that exist and operate that are contingent upon those key networks. And so some of the features of those is that, if you want to be on the iOS store, you can at Apple's whim be kicked off because maybe they want to compete with you, or Google may change the search algorithm that may kind of be devastating, or change your businesses in ways that you don't understand, or Facebook may change the way that the feed shows up or ads. And so I think that there's a chance now for companies to build in this new evolution of the internet with confidence that, look, you can build a company, just take Bitcoin again, because it's an example that most people know. You can build a company around that platform with confidence that is that you're not going to be subject to the whim of a team at Apple saying, oh, you're no longer on the platform.
Yeah. Good analogy. We'll just keep using that one throughout the podcast. So the second playground is becoming a little bit more mainstream, and you as an investor wouldn't really jump in timing-wise if it wasn't mainstream and if there wasn't plenty of opportunity to build a new swing set and a new teeter-totter. So in the old playground that was being built with a goal, right, to either IPO or get acquired or have some sort of liquidity event, whether it's Netscape, Yahoo, YouTube. So I assume, you know, it's not an altruistic thing that you guys do. You would like to have exits. How are those going to look?
Yeah, I think, you know, so that's one of the most exciting things about the second playground. So when the first internet boom happened, certainly a lot of wealth was created, but there was a feature, a characteristic about building value in the first round of the playground that, you know, if you were part of a tech company, if you went to the right addresses in Menlo Park to raise money and you there was definitely a funnel, and a lot of the early value that was created was really protected in these kind of silos, which again, there's nothing sort of, I've benefited from that. There's nothing kind of necessarily clandestine about that. It's just how the industry evolved. And frankly, we didn't have the technology at the time to do what's possible in this next internet. But now what's possible is that now you're hearing this stories with somebody like, well, I put like the third bolt into the new swing set on version two, and I've created a lot of wealth from that, because this quality of, hey, the new playground is not free to use all these things. I mean, look at this. There's a new competitor for a crypto social network. It's not free to set up a profile, but once you do, it's yours. And there's some features that match old social networks, but there's some that are new and interesting. And so the spectrum of value creation is different in that people can participate more freely, and they can participate all the way around the platform. In some cases, and this is what I'm hopeful with content platforms, is that the people who create content around these platforms can benefit in the value that's created right now. If you have a lot of followers on Twitter and you tweet, every tweet is worth, call it $10 to Twitter. You don't see any of that value, even though you're a key market participant on the platform. So in terms of how that works, what it looks like, I'm excited because there's more options for everybody, including investors, to participate in the value earlier on in easier ways. The value tends to be more liquid. So when we talk about venture, I mean, I grew up in as you did, in a venture market where, you know, things were more illiquid than they are in crypto. So I consider what we're doing in crypto to be liquid venture, where, look, it still takes time. It takes elongated incentives to motivate people to do the hard things. Building things is still really hard. Building things that matter, that are subject to the physics of business, like you're providing a real product or service that people want, that still takes time and energy and money. That doesn't magically disappear with crypto. But what is possible is to participate earlier on and have a more liquid instrument of value along the way.
Yeah. So the personas of, you know, Web 1.0, 2.0, as far as like what VCs were looking at, Zuckerberg, Andreessen, Yang, whoever, right?
Yeah.
Fairly accurate. And, you know, you're sitting across the table and you have a good idea based on their personality and acumen and experience. Like, all right, this person's got a good chance.
Yeah.
And then you couple it with market size and all of the other fun stuff. But what's the kind of the persona of a crypto entrepreneur?
Well, it's difficult. I think some of this holds true in for round one of the playground, is that it's really difficult to build something without a technical founder or a real technical job. So I think the ability, so venture had this quality where it had these large markets that you could address. Crypto has even accelerated that. Most projects within crypto are, just take fintech, for instance. they're global by nature, and so they allow, and they're permissionless in ways that allow market participants with a phone and an internet connection to participate in these platforms. I mean, that's somewhat unique, and so I'd say that yeah, they are there. I would say there's more alike than different in that they're ambitious, talented, and but this kind of technical piece is really difficult to do an early stage anything in crypto and not have some technical chops.
Yeah. So when you're a generalist VC, similar to like what, you know, UVF was, right?
Yeah.
Any deal, let's just tackle it. You have to learn a bunch of different business models, sometimes fairly quickly, whether it's like health and medicine or fintech or martech, whatever. So it was really, you know, good practice and fun, but you have to know a lot about crypto and blockchain and all of that to do what you do. How have you kind of learned about it? What are some of your go-tos as far as mentors? What sources do you use for information to make sure you're up to date as the entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so we do. Yeah, we have that. We have UVF as a common thread between us, which was a great learning experience. You know, I think more about what I don't know than what I know, which is I think that one of the key things to recognize about the version 2 playground here is that we don't know. There's more that we don't know than what we do know. And so to stay quite humble, even on things like store of value on a smart contract layer, on a lot of these DeFi, you know, there's really only going to be a few, I think, DeFi protocols that emerge. Sorry, decentralized finance piece of crypto that's happening right now that's quite exciting. There's probably only going to be a few of those. Few of those that really endure that of the current cohort, and so I think staying really humble about you know what we don't know. For us, for instance, though, just we just invested in a lending protocol, and you know one of the things we do is look. We have several professional teams audit these protocols because once these things are in the wild and adopted, there's often no going back. And they can be compromised by really anyone in the world. And so, you know, it's definitely a different kind of process in terms of, you know, putting a protocol out there that is at its, that it, when it's ready to be adopted, than it is for, you know, shipping a V1 or a V2, you know, SDK and version 1 of the internet. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, when you are interacting with these entrepreneurs, how is the deal process and evaluation different for you and your team versus, you know, Bob's Apple Shack?
Yeah,
sells apples.
So I put crypto investors. So there's like it's a big world, right? Lots of different participants, and I put crypto investors in different buckets. So there's a group of investors in crypto that are I compare them to the hedge funds. They're recognizing that there's still a lot of aspects of this market that are not sophisticated. So they're maybe capturing the arbitrage between exchanges, or they find these print money buttons as a result of a new industry that's emerging, and they just keep hitting the print money button until it no longer works. And those guys are all much smarter than I am. There's a whole cohort of these funds, and half of them I don't understand what they're saying when they're talking about their strategy. And then I'd say there's another group of investors that are simply, you know, they're mission-oriented, they're idealistic about whatever it is, and maybe they're not even profit-motivated. They're just trying to create you know, new things in culture and on the playground that people are going to use and love and that will benefit them. And then I'd say I'm a part of a cohort that really believes that the same things that, you know, we talked about early on in venture. So I was mentored by this guy in venture who maybe give his background. We talked about this leading into it and then talk about what we do. So I was mentored in venture by a guy named Donald L. Lucas, who is the founding who's the founding chairman of Oracle. He was actually at Smith Barney as a young guy in New York, and a deal came through. Smith Barney was going to fund it, and they got cold feet. And he said, well, how can I do it on my own? He ended up putting an investment that he borrowed the money from his fraternity brother at the time and invested in this company as National Semiconductor. Ended up joining Draper Gaither Anderson, which was the first venture firm on the West Coast, Tim Draper's grandfather, and brought National as a part of that first deal, which as I understand was the most successful deal in that first fund. Anyway, so Don was a legend in venture capital. We were on a board together by virtue of the University Venture Fund, and the chance opened up for me to go do a mentorship with him. And he really focused on, look, it's first and foremost the people that you're investing in. Are these, he always said, smack you in the face. They just smack you in the face. And I struggled to have a better description than what Don gave me, 20 years ago. They smack you in the face, entrepreneurs. And are they operating in large markets? Execution risk goes down in large markets, generally speaking. Is there some competitive advantage, whether it's IP or some form of 50-to-1 odds that you're going to win? Are there high gross margins? And in crypto, we sometimes look at this in the lens of, look, is there a way to clearly aggregate value? It's difficult to aggregate value, even if you're creating a product or service that's adopted. And so how do you think about this in terms of equity and tokens and these different architectures that are potential that you see on the second playground? And then is there some kind of truth that, and this we go to like a Peter Thiel idea of like, is there some kind of truth that hasn't yet been widely adopted that we've figured out? I mean, we feel like we've figured a few of those out in crypto or in investing in those. So I think that's the boring part. That's the boring part of investing in crypto is for us, is we're actually just trying to apply the same lens that worked for Don for 50 years to a new and very exciting landscape and trying to figure out where each of these ideas about what passes the bar for an investment, how does that apply in crypto?
Yeah. Well, it's a wild, wild west and probably will be for quite some time, don't you think?
I think so. My main thesis, why I got excited about this, was I realized that, and I first got into crypto in 2013 and didn't really understand what it was at that time. And then 2016 took kind of a deeper dive and have been pretty deliberate about developing specific knowledge and a network in that space. We host an invite-only event once a year that kind of attracts the top investors and the top founders in the space, as well as artists and young startups in the space. But I've been pretty deliberate about it because I felt that a crypto-focused strategy would outperform traditional venture over the next 10 years. And I've seen that. I've been in Silicon Valley most of the last 10 years. And I'd see that play out firsthand, where a lot of these firms that I know and respected and still know and respect on Sand Hill Road, they get it, they see it, they're not really set up to go full bore. You mentioned Andreessen, they absolutely have and are very active in the space. But they're more the exception, and I think it's going to be Wild West, and it's going to be a very interesting next 10 years. But that's my thesis. I can't time or predict anything short term. Some people ask me, about where Bitcoin's going to be at the end of the year, or Ethereum, or is there going to be an ETH flipping or whatever. And I, again, back to humility, I have no idea. There's so much competition even for store value and smart layer contract. I don't know how those things are all going to play out. But I do believe with a lot of conviction that a crypto-focused strategy has the chance to outperform traditional venture. And it comes with that as it's riskier.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, when should I buy or sell Bitcoin? But you're not going to tell.
I'm not going to tell you that.
Well, yeah, like with all things, if it's fun and exciting and awesome, you still have to have the time and effort to put into it, right? Because I think, you know, as a VC, you might be like, well, I got 10 more years before I'll shut her down.
Yeah.
Do I want to take the time and effort and learn all this? And because it takes work to get up to speed. So I think it's great that you're rolling the dice in the wild, wild west.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody should do, I mean, anyone participating in this space. And that's the fun thing about doing what I'm doing is you're working with people who are just love what they're so excited about. They're so passionate about it. You have to be, because it hurts so bad. It's so hard to do anything in a startup, and crypto's no exception in some ways, can be more difficult. And so you have to want to do it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. All right, so you guys have what's called a rolling fund.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, rolling fund is a little, I mean, it can behave just like a traditional fund, but the rolling fund is an innovation that AngelList came up with, which is Naval Ravikant's project. But they, the rolling fund is an attempt to create more alignment between the GP, the general partner manager of the fund, and the limited partner. And it gives the LPs more flexibility. They sign up by the quarter, what number, and it can look just like a traditional fund. If they say, look, I'm going to sign up for the next 12 quarters, I want exposure to everything that a given rolling fund's investing in over the next 3 years, and that would give them that. And then they do all the back office and tax and legal and digital custody for folks like us who are doing crypto. So I think it's a cool innovation.
Yeah. Yeah, back office is never overly fun.
Yeah.
And it's not seen. And that sounds like there's another layer of complexity that you need to factor in with crypto.
That's right.
Versus traditional.
That's right. And being compliant is key. And so I think that's a really cool innovation in that way. It makes it easier for people to do. You know, for me, we're hyper focused on deals. So.
Yeah. All right. Last question. As you look at these deals, where are you finding that a lot of these entrepreneurs are coming from? Is it throughout the world? Do you look at local deals? What's your geographic footprint there?
Well, so I'm back in Utah. I'm excited about Utah as a marketplace for deals, and there's a lot of exciting crypto innovators here. We're all products of our experience. So my network is heavily weighted towards Silicon Valley. So it's in most of the projects and things that we've funded to date have come from Silicon Valley. But we, you know, crypto's a global thing. You can't really be in this space. We have done one investment out of Singapore. And we do this conference, which really brings people from all over the world to Utah. So it's the mandate's global, the opportunities are global, and I'm biased towards Silicon Valley because that's where I've been.
Yeah. So last question for real this time. Yeah. A good week as far as like deal flow.
Yeah.
How does that look for you?
What do you mean?
How many deals do you look at per week, per month? Do you want to be inundated and then decide? Like, what's the clip?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I have friends in my network to ask about sending deals and how, and I always say just, you know, feel free to send over projects because, everything is information about the marketplace. You know, I think we're actively tracking, quite a number of projects. I would say around 300 or 400 projects that we sort of try to keep somewhat tabs on. There's so many projects, in the space, thousands and thousands and thousands of projects, in crypto, and then all the companies around those, probably 10,000 crypto token projects, and then a whole cohort of companies around those. And so, look, there's in Silicon Valley, when I first told my friends I was going to just focus entirely on crypto, they're like, oh man, that's too narrow. And I was thinking to myself, it is too big. Someone right now could just launch a fund focused on stablecoins and be busy for the next 10 years. And so, you know, that's really the key, is actually, figuring out, the product market fits, the playground equipment that you think really should exist, focusing on tracking or finding projects and entrepreneurs in that space while also being open to like whatever's coming in so that you have information about what people are willing to risk time and capital to create.
Yeah. And what do you think the percentage of folks that make it through and are able to pitch you and your team and then ultimately fund it percentage-wise?
Well, that's a tiny percentage. It's tough, right? It's tough to get funded. But I would say that someone shouldn't really be discouraged, especially in this new environment, shouldn't be discouraged by, you know, if a professional fund manager or venture fund doesn't give them or the funding that they're seeking doesn't come through, but they really want to build something. There's so many different options in this new landscape in terms of how to fund, how to finance. I think that crypto in general is creating some competition towards traditional financing models. I mean, it's really changing the game in terms of who can participate and who can benefit. And so I think that it can be very challenging to raise money, but at the same time, there's lots of ways to finance a business.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Jared. Now yeah. I know who to ask when I've got crypto questions. People ask me, and I'm like, I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah.
I don't want to fake it, so I'll just ping you.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Happy to be here.